Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Beth. We'll let everyone settle down a little bit. You may not have noticed we were flipping a coin up here to decide who gets to go win. I chose heads. I got to choose to let Dan go first.
I'm sure there's a strategy in that, but that's okay. Thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. It's very special that you would take time out of your evening to come and listen to your candidates, not just if you live in the district, but if you live in the county, because, of course, the decisions made by the Board of Supervisors affect the entire county. I want to thank Integrity Slow for sponsoring this as well. It's important to have as many community events where people can listen to their candidates. Each of us get around out to the neighborhoods, but we all don't always see you at your home when we're out there, so it's great that you could do that. I think what I'm interested in, and if Debbie concurs, is I'll go ahead and just give you a few minutes of my introduction, and then if she wants to do the same, and then we open it up to questions. What do you think,
Debbie? Sounds good to me.
Okay. Let it settle down a little bit more with the chairs. It's great to see this turnout as well. We just like to move chairs.
We've got an extra seat here.
And I'm gonna try and keep this part fairly brief because I know for me, I want to hear from you and what issues are important to you. I think any of us in this position could talk for hours, literally. And I know that's not what you're here to do. You're here to ask questions, and I think we both want to hear
what you
ask. So let me give you a little history about me. My name is Dan Carpenter again. I am in my sixth and final year of the San Luis Obispo City Council. I spent the previous 8 years to that on their advisory bodies, including the Planning Commission. So about 14 years of being involved in city politics and policies. My background is I'm a lifetime resident of San Luis Obispo. My family has been in this third district for 150 years. Two of my great-grandparents immigrated through Avila Beach. My grandparents, great-grandparents Squire, settled Squire Canyon, and they lived in it until the 1950s when they sold it, and it's been divided off, and you see how beautiful it is now. The other side of me, my Portuguese side, my great-grandfather immigrated through Avila, ended up in Edna Valley as a dairy farmer. And so I have lots of roots, deep roots in the district, and so I've been fortunate to spend my entire life here. And so as a youngster in Avila, and I'm only addressing Avila right now because we're physically here, but my grandmother had a trailer out at Harbor Terrace where that's going, and we spent every summer down here. It was just beautiful as a child. And then I got to see the transition back in the 80s and 90s from the old Avila Beach to the new Avila Beach, and I pretty much embraced that that change. I've watched it very closely, not from an elected position, but as an interested party who's been a part of Avila my entire life. So just basically, I govern without partisan politics. I'm very pragmatic in my approach. If you've ever seen me on the city council in San Luis, I don't play the partisan piece of it. I don't have political allies. I approach every issue, like I said, from a pragmatic, common-sense approach. So sometimes I'll land on one side or the other. I'm somewhat maybe unpredictable, and I think that's good. I do my homework, and obviously in our process of being an elected official, we talk to a lot of people. We do a lot of extra work outside of what staff supplies us. So the important thing, too, that I've noticed as I'm transitioning from the city to county is, and I think this is an advantage Debbie and I have over the incumbent, is both of us have served in cities, in jurisdictions that are very defined, clear, very condensed areas. And so when we look at this position, when I look at it, most of what the decisions I will be making as your supervisor have to do with the rural area. Most of the cities, San Luis, Grover, and Pismo, the three incorporated cities, they have their city councils, and they make the decisions in the city of San Luis. It's a charter city, which is very independent from the county. So when I looked at this position, and I said, well, you know, why, Dan, do you want to do this? And I laughed, too. My wife did as well. It's challenging for me. We do a lot of urban planning in cities, and we're very restricted, especially in San Luis, by our green open space, and so it's a lot of infill. And so the attraction for me is obviously getting out into the county where my family were pioneers and stewards of this land is very attractive for me. And so that is what has drawn me into to running for supervisor. Plus, I asked a lot of friends of mine in this political world if they would run in this election, and all of them said, are you kidding me? No way. We think you should, Dan. So being the glutton for punishment, I threw my hat in the ring about March of last year, made my decision to run. I think part of it was obviously my desire to be a supervisor and continue my public service, but also I saw this district was not being represented properly or in the way I would expect it to be. I think the bullying, the disrespect for the people who come to the microphone and speak, I think some of the disparaging remarks is just uncharacteristic of the type of county that I've lived in my entire life. And I really embrace public input, the public speaking part, where you come to us and tell us what we need to do for you. And so I think that's why this format tonight works well. You'll get to come up to the microphone, ask us questions, and we'll answer them for you. That's the part I like. If I don't agree with you, there won't be any disparaging remarks, I promise. And so these are the changes I think that need to happen with our District 3 leadership. I'm just not satisfied, and I don't want to tear another person down. I think it's obvious for those of you who live in the district and even outside what type of supervisor you have. I am the antithesis of that when it comes to respect for people and definitely not a bully. So as we've moved on in the campaign, this is 10 months into it, my campaign is a lot of volunteers. I don't raise a lot of money because I don't have a lot of special interests that support me. I don't have the big developers, and we can get into more of that later if you have questions. I don't have any other special interest groups that are sending me the big checks, but I get a lot of small checks from the important people, and that's the people like you who are out there making a living on fixed income retirements and send me $25 or $50. All of that's very important. In fact, one constituent sent me a dollar in an envelope, and she said, Dan, this is all I can afford. I'm on a fixed income on Social Security. And it meant everything to me. I would rather have that dollar for that one vote than a $5,000 check for one vote. That tells me that people are paying attention and how important civility is, how important being genuine to the people in your community is. It's they recognize it, and I think that's why they're begging for a change in District 3. So anyway, the campaign's going on. We're walking a lot of the entire district, but we identified about 12,000 high propensity voters, my volunteer team, and we've already walked about 2/3 of that. We hope to finish it by the end of February. We're getting out. We're talking to everyone. We want to hear what you guys have to say. What do you expect from your next supervisor? Are you satisfied with your supervisor? Do you want to change? What kind of change do you want? And so me leaving them as much information, speaking candidly about the issues as they come up, is something that people appreciate. So I'm hearing all kinds of things, as I'm sure Debbie is as well, and even our incumbent. And I think it's important to listen, and that's one of my what I feel I've done well in the 6 years on the city council. As I listen to people, I embrace that public comment, and I act on it. So without taking any more time, a lot of the things I can talk about, but I want to turn the microphone over to Debbie, let her give you her background, and then we can go from there. We'll see how it goes.
Thank you, Dan. I know there were a lot of things vying for your time this evening. I've heard someone told me there was a television show they were missing. And I came from the Arroyo Grande Grover Beach Chamber of Commerce annual dinner. They started dinner after I left. And I understand there was a Sierra Club meeting that some of you missed. And most importantly, the Republican debate, and we're still waiting to see if Donald Trump might come through that back door. So I have a cunning plan. I'm going to put this chair out front in case Trump or any other candidate we're interested in shows up. So seriously, thank you very much for coming. And I also did want to say thank you also to Kevin Rice. Kevin has spent a lot of his own money, and it's taken a lot of time to organize this for all of you to come. And he's bent over backwards to make sure that it is fair to all concerned. And I know that both Dan and I both suffered from that and appreciate it. It's difficult when you have to run a meeting and be the candidate debating. I was the first one who launched my campaign, and I'm really glad we're doing this evening in Avila, and maybe that's why we're doing it, because both Dan and I have been clearly committed to Avila, and I launched my campaign early in March at the entrance to Wild Cherry Canyon. So the issues that you've been facing with development are issues that I've been concerned about countywide. Avila Beach is the canary in the mine. The water issues you face, the development issues you face, are the same issues that we have in many other areas of the county. More pronounced because you're a small community in a very small, tight space. Talking a little bit about the county, Dan mentioned it to some extent. Basically, supervisors are, and most of you probably know, you're probably fairly committed to local politics. That's why you're here. The supervisors are the board that makes the decisions and that runs the county, basically. There are five of us. There are five districts. We're District 3. The supervisors oversee the budget. We distribute federal and state funding and our local tax funds for land use, social services, infrastructure, and emergency services. So as Dan said, cities do some of the work, the state does some of the work, and the federal government does some, and we also distribute some of those funds that come to us from all of those sources. This, as Dan said, is a nonpartisan position on the ballot, and there are two supervisor regions, districts that are up for election this year. We've got ours, District 3, and District 5 is also going through an election. In ours, we have Dan Carpenter, Debbie Peterson, and Adam Hill. So I wanted to give you just a little bit about my background, something I don't talk about very much because it was a long time ago, and it's not relevant in the sense that many of you might not even know where I'm talking about. You'll know when I say I grew up in Fresno. That one's pretty straightforward. And I, I'm not the only one. I am like many folks who are transplants here, and I spent weekends at Avila for all of my youth and camped here, and that's why I have been so grateful to all that the state parks do for us, because they really informed my youth. A lot of my learning came there. And I have a Bachelor of Science degree in communication, and I spent my first year out of college helping my mother launch her business called the Brownie Baker. You may have seen Brownie Baker brownies and cookies in markets and restaurants around the state. After I worked with my mother for a year, I decided that I wanted to work abroad, so I went to Glasgow, Scotland, where I started my career working for an advertising agency, and I also worked for a bank. I worked doing public relations and market research for both companies. Meanwhile, my mother's business in Fresno was thriving, so much so that they were buying investment property in Pismo Beach. And I also realized that the glass ceiling in Glasgow was significantly lower than the glass ceiling in California at that time. And that if I wanted to get ahead in a career, and by then I decided I was going to stick around in Scotland for a while, that I was going to have to start my own business. That would be the only way I was really going to be able to move forward. So I also observed that the shipyards of Glasgow had 33% male unemployment. So I asked myself, these folks in Scotland are letting me live here. I don't really belong here. I'm not a citizen. So what could I do? How can I return that favor? What's the highest good I could do in this community? And I realized that the highest good would be create jobs. And so I, from my market research, knew that my mother's company could do very well because of the British sweet tooth. And I thought, I could do that. So I took a 16-week course at Glasgow University on entrepreneurship. I learned all about budgets and cash flow and business plans, started baking my mother's recipes, and I was the first person who launched carrot cake and brownies in Great Britain. By 1995, when I sold the company, it was trading at $6 million a year. We had 85 employees. We had a warehouse in London for distribution. We sold to all the supermarkets, the airlines, British Rail, British Airways, and we had some subsidiaries. We had a trucking subsidiary that distributed our cakes, two retail shops, and two other bakeries. And after that, when I sold my business to a management buy-in, and I was the first woman in Scotland to be able to sell to a management buy-in, to get funding for that. After that, I worked as a management consultant for several redevelopment companies in the United Kingdom, not doing development as such, but helping small businesses get started. So I consulted with startup companies and also with manufacturing companies that needed to restructure and regroup and look at their product lines and bring themselves up to speed or close down. And so I worked doing that, and that's where I really got efficient on understanding cash flow and how that all works and why it works and doesn't work. My focus there, of course, would have been on food manufacturing and marketing. But by 1998, all of my family in Fresno had moved over here, and my two-year-old son, his dad and I knew he was going to be an only child, and we really wanted to raise him somewhere where he would be near our family. And my mother kept telling me Grover Beach is paradise, and every time we visited, we had to agree with her. So we transitioned back to California, his dad and I, as brokers for California boutique wineries and locally, who wanted to export in Great Britain. Locally, we represented Peachy Canyon, and we managed to get their wine in the wine cellar where the Napoleon, actually drank wine. And the market changed significantly, and the dollar was way too high to be able to export. And so I set up in 1999 with my mother with Peterson Team Realty, and that business is still going. It's now located in Grover Beach. And we focus primarily on investment properties and on second homes. I also do a lot of contracted specialized right-of-way agency work for the government and for corporations, which is also helps me have an understanding of a whole lot of things in government that are useful, especially with infrastructure projects. And when we moved to Grover, I could see that the city really needed some help with its image, that they needed help with redevelopment and with jobs, with business creations, and I thought, I can do that. So I was appointed to the Planning Commission in 2004, and then in 2008, as the chair of the Planning Commission, I ran for City Council. I served for 4 years there. And then in 2012, I ran for mayor and became the first directly elected mayor in the city of Grover Beach. And I guess we're going to open for questions now. And I think it would be a good idea if folks would line up, and that way we make best use of everybody's time so that everybody gets a chance. And just be cognizant, as we're trying to be, of everybody's time so that everybody gets an opportunity, because our time's limited tonight. Thank you.
I think also, if you don't have a question and you want to make a comment too, I think that's fine. Just keep in mind, like Debbie mentioned, that, you know, other people's time, and we're constrained to the 2 hours, but we really want to hear from you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And I want to thank Kevin Rice for doing this. Thank you, Kevin. And I thank the two of you for coming tonight and for facing us and answering our questions. The empty chair is quite visible. Well, you've already mentioned a few things that differentiate you, and I was just wanting you to talk more about the things that make you feel most qualified for this position and would would cause us to want to vote for you as supervisor.
Would you like to hear that from both of us? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. Would you like me to go first?
Yeah, go. It's your turn.
Well, I didn't touch on my professional background. I spent 20 years in my family business. My family had a business in San Luis for 90 years, and I was fortunate enough to be a small business owner for 20 years. And then when we closed the business, I went to work out at Cal Poly and ran one of their departments in the bookstore. So my degree from Cal Poly is in business management. It was very easy to transition into our family business. And so to this elected office, I brought my business skills, my skills of, you know, you only have so much money to spend and you don't spend any more than that, and kind of what you do at home. And that's not always the case with elected officials. In fact, I serve on a council where that understanding, I took for granted that people had that, and they don't. They have a mindset that we will just create more income. And so that's what I have brought to my elected position, is a common sense approach that each of us do in our own household. We have so much income, we only spend so much money, and we do it with discretion. We don't just take that money and spend it haphazardly. And I think there's the extra burden on each of us that we're spending your money. This is your money, not mine. And so I feel that extra responsibility to do that. Some of the issues that we've differed on, I mean, I could go back and mention a couple that came up recently. And I try to attend every Board of Supervisors meeting as a visible candidate and learning all the time, too. I mean, we could sit at home and listen. But one of the ones that came up, I'm very supportive of private property rights. And I think many of the realtors here, there are probably some in the audience and the ones I associate with, a couple ordinances lately in San Luis and then in the county as well. But the county one I'm referring to is Section 8 housing, and it's something that's very important to those who need housing. But what the board brought about was an action to mandate landlords to take Section 8 housing applications. And the law already, the state law, mandates not to discriminate against Section 8 applicants. And so the incumbent tried as hard as he could to have that invoked by supporting it. Fortunately, the majority denied that mandate on landlords, and I was happy with that the majority saw the light. So those kind of takings of property rights bother me. I think each of us, given the opportunity to do the right thing, we do. I think overregulation is something that just probably wears me down at times. I'm in a community where we regulate everything from odors to rooftops to all kinds of crazy things, and so that's what I bring, and I can get into more of the decisions that I would disagree with, but I want to leave it before I turn over to Debbie with my observation anyway in this election, in this district, is that character is an issue, the way people are treated. You can talk about voting issues, but I think the way we treat people is just as an important issue, maybe even more important, because the foundation of our character drives how we vote. And so I think if that's solidified initially, then you don't have to worry about the motivation of how that person votes. And so to me, the character of a person is just as much. So I'll let Debbie go from there.
One of the things that Dan also touched on is board composition. And the first thing I had to do when I was 24 years old, starting a company in a foreign country, was figure out how the heck I was going to get the knowledge that I didn't have that I needed to be able to run a company, especially in another country. And so I started researching, and I had the help, of course, from my course at Glasgow University and my contacts there. I started researching what makes a good board, and that has stood me in incredibly good stead for all of these years. And one thing that I've observed is that most people who are sitting on boards have very little understanding of that. They may have sat on a nonprofit board, but that's very different. The rules and regulations and the laws, the principles of integrity are always the same. The principles of transparency are always the same. But there are many other things that are very different. And so what we find is on many of our county boards,
I think, and in, especially in our districts, we have people sitting who don't understand their roles and responsibilities, and things get out of hand. When that's the case, the tail wags the dog, and we end up with staff who are running our county instead of the people and the people's elected representatives. So that is something that's very, very important to me, is I want to hear from you. And like Dan, I've been walking and knocking on doors and listening to people. And when you come to meetings, I will be thrilled to have you stand up and ask me questions. And you can disagree with me, and that's fine, because then I may learn something that I didn't know already. And vice versa, you may learn something from me, because I'm going to spend a lot of time trying to understand what those issues are and trying to make fair decisions. So boards, number one, I think are a way in which I would certainly, I suspect that I came to my experience in government, my work in government, with a much better understanding and background than our current supervisor. The other thing that has been very, very helpful to me has been being mayor. When you're on the council, you don't have quite the same exposure. Of course, that's for better and for worse. But by exposure, I mean you don't have the opportunity to go to as many meetings, to meet as many of the other leaders in the community, and to get to as many parts of the county. So as mayor, I was able to get to know the county better. And, of course, was able to get to know San Luis better, because everything, most everything, happens in San Luis Obispo, except for our first debate here. So it gave me a much better understanding of San Luis Obispo and that community, but also of the other communities in the county and the issues also. And then finally, I think the other thing that I bring to the table that's critical here in Avila is that we only have one other supervisor who has any representation of our coastal communities. And I think it's really important, because our coastal communities drive our tourism business, which vies with agriculture as being our number one economic engine. So I think we need a supervisor who understands and has worked in coastal communities, all of the issues that come with tourism, all of the issues that come with parking, with high summers, and also that understand the issues that come with the Coastal Commission. Because the other supervisors in the other communities don't get beach towns, because they don't live in them and don't have to work with the Coastal Commission. I successfully fought for my city, Grover Beach, successfully fought an appeal to the Coastal Commission. We won, and we managed to move forward, and also built very good relationships with our local Coastal Commission representatives. And I'm going to stop there then, and let, unless you want to rebut.
Keep the answers a little shorter, I hope, and allow you to ask more questions. I'll try to be more brief.
We'll run out of stuff soon enough.
Yeah, apparently.
Your answer might be more brief for this one. I'm very interested in homelessness, and it's a growing issue in our county. I don't think it's a problem, but it's an issue. And I think it's really inhumane that we have people living just outside by the creek and all these other places, some in wheelchairs even. And I also think it's inhumane that we make them sleep one place, get up at 5 or 6 a.m. and go someplace else. And so I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or ideas that you might want to press regarding the issue of homelessness for the whole county.
I went first. You want to go first this time?
Yes, and it is a difficult issue, and it's something I've been aware of for the last 10 years and felt pretty overwhelmed by. But I'm beginning to feel as if we've got some coherence. First of all, we're in a better position as a county than we were last year or 2 years ago. Now our homeless figures are 30% less generally, and I think 40% less for veterans. That doesn't make it any more humane for people to be living in horrible situations along creek beds. And so the things that I've been observing are, first of all, there is a program called SOAR, and that program enables people who are eligible for disability to get it in 6 months if they use that protocol. And the county is able to administer that program. There are federal funds for it. And it will enable people who have disabilities, who perhaps have especially mentally ill folks, it will enable them to get their disability in 6 months instead of 2 months, 2 years, or never. So I would encourage all of you, you can go online, Google SOAR, there's training. You can train for SOAR, and you can help people before they become homeless, or you can help people after they've become homeless. The problem is that when you're in that situation, you're not good at filling out applications.
But if you have someone who knows the way to do it to get your services quickly, that's helpful. That's one thing. The other thing is that a few weeks ago, a former neighbor asked me if I would take a walk, if I would get a few folks. I got surf riders and some local business owners to take a walk through Meadow Creek in Grover Beach. And the conditions we encountered there are the worst I have seen anywhere in the world except one other place. I've been in Ethiopia, I've been in Syria, I've been in a lot of places where there are some tough conditions, but I have never seen anything as bad or worse than this. In the United States, in my backyard, there were people who were living with no sanitation, covered in trash everywhere, and you've seen it on TV, you've seen what it looks like, and it's an inhumane situation. We are supposed to be a civilized country. Now, the advantage to doing something like that and filming it and taking photos and distributing them is that we become aware of it. And those people who are struggling with people digging through their trash cans, with crime, with the drug addiction that's taking place down there, with some of the prostitution, the human trafficking that's happening in the woods, the people who are affected by that, instead of saying, we want those horrible people out of here, instead of saying that, they're saying, what can we do to help? We need to do something. This can't happen. We need to have a place for these people to have a home. And so I think that one of the things that's really important to me is to expose it, open it up, shine a light on it, let people see what it really looks like. And I think then we have a community will to make some positive choices that change things. And I'll stop with that right now.
Okay. Let me give you a little background first. Most of you know the majority of our homeless population live in and around the city of San Luis. And while the enumeration numbers were down, I don't believe our homeless population is really down. They are there. I believe that group, that part of our population is growing, actually, as they're not able to recover from the economy, and we see more and more, at least I do. I have a routine twice a week where I go down actually into the creek and under the bridges in San Luis, and I just a routine and just to check in on a few people that choose that lifestyle but would prefer something else, but they choose it. But aside from that, the other thing we do in San Luis is we have an overflow shelter. We have an overnight shelter and then an overflow. The churches and synagogues split up the overflow for the women, children, families, and I've done that. January is our month. I know some of you in here also participate in that program, and it's a wonderful program. It gives them a warm, comfortable place away from the overnight shelters, and January is our month. I've been doing it for probably over a dozen years, but to answer the question specifically, what can we do? I think... And I wrote an article recently about affordable housing. Ultimately, we have to get our housing to a price where people can afford to live in it. Housing First program is a program that was nationally adopted many years ago. Utah has taken that on, and they have virtually no homeless. It's a matter of putting people in a home first and then wrapping the services around them. And when they do that, 85% don't end up in homeless. Don't end up homeless again. And the key is, and I think you, most all of you would understand that when you have a place where you're secure, you can put your things down, you don't have to pack them up at 5 in the morning and take all your belongings with you, and you have a place to put your food and be warm at night and secure, that your opportunity for success goes up quickly. And so that's the answer, is to put them into provide homes. But then the second part of that is we don't have the homes. And so that's the part I addressed, and I've brought this to my city council before, and now I've brought it out publicly to the entire county, is what are we doing as agencies, cities, and county to incentivize that type of building? We're not offering our builders those incentives to build on smaller lot sizes, to build smaller homes, to put more units in one building where we can actually afford people who have fixed incomes that are very minimal, that can actually afford to pay a nominal rent to stay in those places. So I think, one, we have to recognize that putting them into a home first is their best opportunity for success. And number two, as your elected leaders, we need to do everything we can to incentivize the type of homes that they would go into. So I think that is the answer. Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you for having it, and thank you for being here. A basic precept of a free citizenry is private property rights. And I even, Bruce Gibson mentioned at one meeting that he would not use eminent domain for recreational purposes like the Bob Jones Trail or something of that nature. And what I'm asking is, what is your position, both of you, on using eminent domain to take away people's private property in order to achieve some government goal? Thank you.
Well, I'll jump in on that one. It's a really interesting question, and it's one that I know a huge deal amount about, because as a right-of-way agent, I work for people who are widening roads and putting in sewer systems and putting up electrical lines, and in order to be able to do that, they need to purchase the rights to do that, and you have to have some land to do those things. So often they're only purchasing a right-of-way to put lines underground. That is an eminent domain process, but it's not stealing something that we're stealing. That's how it feels to people. It's not taking something that you're going to be affected by seriously. When you start getting into taking people's homes, that's a different question. And so my view is that eminent domain is there for a reason. It's there so that we can make sure that all of us have electricity coming through, that all of us have water coming through the pipes, that all of us have a sewer system coming through, because we didn't start out anticipating all of those things. And I am, as a real estate broker, of course, I'm very committed to private property ownership, because we have to have that. In fact, for most of us, that's what's driving our retirement. The upside, and as a right-of-way agent, the upside to it is that the law is very, very strong on making sure that people are not ripped off. So when people are in a position of having to give up their land, our goal is to usually try to have it be done voluntarily. And they have to be given the highest appraised value. If they're living in say, a mobile home park that needs to be relocated, they have to be given a great deal of financial support and help to move. And so the law is pretty good on protecting people's rights, and I will tell you that as a real estate agent, I commit to being fair to all concerned. The law says I have to do that, and so I will always, not only as a real estate agent, but also working with local government, making some of those tough decisions, I will always be fair to all concerned. So I understand that there's a need for eminent domain sometimes, but not necessarily that eminent domain where you see the big development coming in and you know, we've seen it happen where big developers come in and take away homes from areas by calling them blighted when perhaps they are communities that aren't blighted and they're not fixing anything. So I would, like anything, it doesn't usually come to the Board of Supervisors to make that decision, but if it did, I certainly would want to listen very carefully and consider very carefully before we would ever take a decision like that. But as a rule, you can't just go take people's homes, if that's any consolation.
Well, I'm a big proponent of private property rights. For me, and I can keep the answer pretty simple, as a last resort, and I think that sometimes our government agencies forget that, as a last resort eminent domain for the public benefit, and that's the gray area, is your elected leaders are deciding what that gray area is, what is public benefit, and what slops over into some private benefit from it. So I simply, as a last resort. Thank you.
Good evening. Hi. Do you believe the urgency water ordinance was a valid crisis before all evidence was in? Why or why not?
I think they jumped the gun. It's there again. It's a it took the rights away from overliers, and the ordinance, this final passage of it after they passed it a couple times and then it had a lapse and then they did it again. It's a one-to-one offset, and I think there again that takes away people's private property rights. They have the reasonable and beneficial use of the water below their property as an overlier. And I think now they have devalued people's property rights by setting that on there. If you're a dry harvest farmer and then all of a sudden you want to put some crops in that require water, now you have to go out and buy those rights from somebody else. I'm not a proponent of the urgency ordinance.
Okay.
it's interesting that you phrase it. Well, first of all, to answer your question, no. And it's very interesting that you phrase it as the urgency ordinance, because that is what it really is, but it was repackaged as the county conservation ordinance, and which of us don't want that? But our county has been so diligent, each of our communities and all of our that's my mic. Is it better now? Yeah, there we go. So each of our communities and each of our county agencies have been diligent and been legislated to be very careful with conservation, and people in our county have been amazing with how they've conserved. Especially, I'm going to say, Grover Beach has been incredible, and Cambria and Los Osos, where you're really struggling. So for me, it was, I'm going to say it was a crock. We spent $1 million to put in, give someone a paper-pushing job to monitor things that where we really, what we really need to be doing as a county is not having more paper pushing, not counting whether or not you have a low-flow toilet and paying some contractor $300,000+ to go look in your house to say that you have a low-flow toilet. What we need to do is take that $1 million and we need to motivate and enable and empower the folks who are working at the county who are highly educated, very talented individuals, get them to work together to create instead. And to some extent, we'll get it with a state water management plan, but we could fast track that to instead evaluate all of our options for water and evaluate which ones are the short term, which ones are the emergency fix, which ones are the 5 years, and which ones are the long term, and evaluate the costs, evaluate the benefits, and then make a choice as to what we do. But it's not to just call something conservation when we're already doing so well and basically pass the buck.
Well, thanks for running.
You're welcome.
According to the website Transparent California, there is a number of administrative, managerial, and safety personnel that work for the County of San Luis Obispo whose wages and benefits exceed $200, $250, $300, $350, almost $400,000 per year. Do you folks have any idea how to roll back some of these excessive salaries?
Here you go.
I can't remember where we are.
I can address that. Well, as most of you may or may not know, most of the employees are in bargaining units. And so once back in the 70s, I believe it was, when public employees started organizing and having bargaining units, those things were negotiated. So the only way those can be negotiated down is through the negotiating process when the contracts end. And so what I have noticed in the years of going through negotiations with our staff is, and I believe it's the same with the county, and especially with public safety, is they use comparable cities. And you negotiate those comparable cities, and so they bring to the table the ones that would make their negotiation strategy look better. In fact, two bargaining units we have in San Luis refused to use Santa Maria as a comparable city because the wages are lower. And so they refused to use one of our county agencies as a comparable agency because they're lower. So they typically pick ones, and it's a good strategy for them. And if we, as your policymakers, allow that through negotiations, then by default we're condoning it. And so it is happening. Your elected leaders are allowing it to happen. I think it's out of control. I think we need to bring those back into something reasonable. We have a city manager in the city of San Luis that makes more than the governor as well. And it's difficult. I have been in that process. I have been the only one at times who have tried to argue that down, and it really takes a majority of your elected leaders to set the tone, the culture of what your community is going to accept, and it helps when you have forums like this where people tell you, look, we think those salaries and benefits are exorbitant. You guys need to take those down. But I'll tell you, in the bureaucratic mindset that people are set in their ways. In fact, Anytime you have a person, I think, that stays in office more than a couple terms, they start to think like the agency, and they start to act like the agency. Instead of representing you, they're representing the agency because they get steeped in that. And that's why I think good turnover in elected office is important. And that's one of the reasons I decided to leave the city council after 6 years is it's time for new blood, and it's time for new ideas, and it's time for that thinking outside the box. And that's why I believe in this particular district that 2 terms with our incumbent is enough. It's time for somebody else who will bring a different type of thinking, and that may not be, thank you. And so it broadens the conversation. Well, right now, I think the longer you stay in your position, the more funneled your thinking becomes, where if you bring somebody new in, they bring in ideas and ask questions that haven't been thought of for a long time. So I look forward for the opportunity to give our staff with the county direction to negotiate some of those salaries down.
Hear, hear. What's happened, and especially the problem, is that as you start, if you're working in one of the lower level jobs, you're not going to be making that much more. But as it goes up and you continue to take percentage increases, that gap grows wider and wider and wider. And I think what has happened is that we've forgotten that the institution is you. It is not, you are the shareholders. You are the ones who fund the institution, and instead the institution, as Dan said, becomes the end all and or the be all and the end all, and we forget that we're serving, that really customer service is what this is all about, representation. And so they ratchet up. And one of the biggest problems we have is as we continue with those percentage increases, then that gap gets wider and wider and wider, and the higher wages get wider, higher and higher and higher. And we've forgotten that the original intent of being involved in serving your community, of being a civil servant, is not to get rich. We were supposed to come in and serve for a period, move away from our profession or our career or our vocation, serve for a period, and then go back, not get rich. And I think that now we've started comparing government jobs, we've lost hold of that, we started comparing government jobs with jobs out in the open market, and saying that if you work in the government, you should get the same. If you work in the government, it should be your vocation, it should be done because you want to serve. And not to say that you shouldn't get a fair wage or a good wage, but we've gone way over the top in a number of areas with that. I would stand back from that for university and college lecturers. I think that they're the victims of that same thing, where you've got administrators with huge salaries that forget maybe that they are civil servants and they think they should be earning industry wages or salaries. And you've got the lecturers who are right out there working with our children who are struggling, and maybe some of that balance needs to be redressed there also. I would also, the other reason it's such a big problem, and I will definitely advocate for getting it under control, the other reason it's such a big problem is pensions. If we're paying someone a 90% pension of a $300,000 salary, and then they retire, and then the next person comes in and serves for 10 years, and then they retire, and then the next person comes in, because many of us live to 90 or more, you are paying 3 people $300,000 a year to be your city manager, and we cannot sustain that. Those funds, that $300,000 a year times 3, is something that could really help address the balance. We could take those funds and put that towards people who are living in creek beds.
On a similar note, a lot of what you just addressed was what I had intended to ask, but I want to get down to specifics on one thing, and that is administrative salaries and the way we choose government administrators, top management. It seems to me, I've observed working with the South County Sanitary District over the past year, that there's a tendency to not do a real good job of evaluating potential candidates for a job, and also, and even more importantly, to just go with this a similar thing to your comparable salaries that you talked about for public safety people. It seems like somebody's telling government organizations that they have to pay this salary to get the best. And I'm wondering if that really is true, or is this just some kind of a little racket among those people in that business, the business of administration? And I'd like to hear your comments from both of you on that.
You want to go first?
I'll go first this
time.
Go
ahead.
Yeah. That's what I was really referring to when I said ratchet it up, because if you go and get more money from the next guy, and then the next guy comes back and says, but they're getting more, and then you keep going back and forth on that, then it becomes an untenable situation. And I would agree with you, and if you care to watch Channel 21 or go on to Slow Span or to AGP, you'll see that I've stood up in many, many, many meetings at our South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District and said, you do not need a full-time administrator at $200,000 a year for a $3 million district. And I think we need to be saying that more. We could do it with a part-time manager. And I can tell you, I know that, because I've run a manufacturing company. I understand the culture of a company, I understand cash flow, and I know when I look at it whether they're spending too much money, especially then when you figure in the pension also.
Yes, and I want to go right along with that. It's what happens, the culture in that upper administrative field is exactly that. We hire just our top administrators in the city, same with the county, and then they hire the other hundreds and hundreds of people. But the argument is always that we have to pay more for retention, because there's retention cost if you have, or turnover cost if they turn over. So we always have to hire the best. I don't know that that's the case, that we always have to hire the best. I think the local labor market is important to evaluate before you stick these high salaries out there. There are people who are willing to live in this community for less, and we never test that, because we typically do these statewide or countrywide search, and people, you know, see the salaries and they say, well, I've got to go over. I mean, it's great to come there. They see the property values, and of course, a lot of them can't afford it if they're coming from back east, where maybe the property values are half or a third. And so that's the way it gets ratcheted up, is that, well, I can't afford to move there. I have a trailing spouse who can't get a job. And so we need to pay them more. I think the problem is that we don't lean on our local labor market enough. We have people, very talented people in our county that could do the job, but we tend to want to go outside. We just hired a new police chief in San Luis, and I think she's wonderful. But we had two captains who had been there many years, both applied for the chief position, and we didn't hire them. They're both qualified. I know them well. They've been there for many years. And I don't make that decision. The city manager makes that decision. But I can tell you the cost of doing that search was probably close to $35,000, $40,000 to hire someone from the outside when we had qualified people inside and who are committed to our community. So I think the answer is to go back to our local labor market and start to hire locally.
Well, Dan and Debbie, thanks for being here tonight. Here's my question. I want to talk about Avila. So I'm going to ask the audience, how many folks call Avila home? Can you raise your hand? Thank you. Not that many. Thank you. Because Avila, as you know, is an unincorporated area. So here's my question. We have issues. We have a pier that's down. It's going to cost millions to repair that. We have major developments, the Chevron project, the golf course, Harbor Terrace. We have an Avila Beach specific plan that's somewhat out of date depending on the different building that's going on in this community. So for the small residents, the small community of folks who live in Avila Beach, we're in desperate need of representation. So talk to me about how you're going to represent the residents of Avila Beach, where this growth is taking place, this transition of a community is changing rapidly. And as I look at my relatives who are on the walls behind you, I'm thinking, what would be the question they would have been asking 50, 7,500 years ago? We are a different place and need new thinking and a different vision. So talk to us about how you're going to represent the people of Avila Beach. We have a port commission here. We have an Avila Beach Civic Center. We have Avila Beach Community Service District. We have the Friends of Avila. We have Avila Beach, Avila Valley Advisory Council. So how are you going to represent us, and what are you going to tell us? Talk to us. Dan, I'll start with you.
Okay, you start with me. Good question, and thank you for bringing up AVLA, because we are here. There again, I'm just going to go back to my history a little bit, and having been here before AVLA did the transition, and it has changed. It has changed a lot. What we are neglectful of doing is a new San Luis Bay area plan, and that the Board of Supervisors have been given that direction. And I really think we need to sit back on all of this proposed development that's coming to us and tell that plan. Success comes in planning when you're allowing development is to have a good plan in place first, so you're not spot developing here and there. You have a plan for development, and part of that plan for development includes circulation, water, sewer, all those things that go with growth. And so I think what I'm seeing and feeling as I spend more and more time here is that we got the cart before the horse. I think the area plan needs to be in place first before we move forward. We have one ingress, egress in AVLA. That hasn't changed, but yet we have more events happening in AVLA. You have more at the golf course, and sometimes 3,000 are out at the lighthouse, you have a lot. And then you have Diablo Canyon and that traffic. And so we have a real circulation problem in AVLA. And I think what I would do if elected is immediately put that message out there that let's push this area plan up quicker and let's get it done before we have, and I know the Chevron project up here on AVLA Point is already started in the EIR process. And it's going to come out that there are these, you know, class one impacts that can't be mitigated. And so what do we do then? Are we giving these developers a false sense of hope that their development is actually going to go through? And I don't know who at the Board of Supervisors is giving them that. Maybe the gentleman who would be sitting here next to me is. But I assure you, they are going to get stalled at some point because they're not going to be able to do that. And so the residents who have made this their home for decades or even new residents are going to sacrifice their quality of life if we continue to move forward with this development. And I think it all started in the transition after the Unocal cleanup and the new construction happened, and then it's become more desirable to be here, and we've developed the estates and all the other areas that weren't here back when you and I were a child. And so I think we have grown, and it's still, you know, the jewel of our county. But how do we protect that from this massive development? So, like I said, my position is let's push this area plan forward, let's adopt it, and then let's live by it.
And I didn't hear anything about the pier.
Pardon me?
I didn't hear anything about the pier.
Oh, I didn't talk about the pier. You mean as far as funding it or getting it done?
Any ideas?
Any ideas?
We have a pier that's no longer functional.
Right. There again, it takes...
Crown jewel of the Central Coast.
Yeah. It takes the commitment of the funding for the supervisors, and we know they spend millions of dollars on things that are discretionary, and so it's a matter of saying, and there again, we need $5 million for the pier, we appropriate it, and it's going to be taking from something else, but it's a matter of your supervisor in District 3 saying, AVLA is that important that we're going to set there, and that they argue for that at the supervisors meeting and say, you know what, we've got an extra $10 million that we are going to spend, and that happens over realized revenue, and then the supervisors make choices. Where do we want to spend it? Everybody advocates for their district, of course, but your supervisor should be sitting up there advocating that this is the crown jewel, like you referred to, of the county.
Thank you.
I will encourage, as Dan's suggesting, I will encourage the board and the county to remember what is our number one economic engine. It's tourism. Where should we be focusing funds, especially one-time funds, as Dan mentioned? Where do we put them? If you put them on the pier in AVLA, you provide a situation that brings more and more people here. Now, not just necessarily to AVLA, but more and more people here to the county to continue to support our economy. And the elephant in the room, I think, is that PG&E may not be here forever. And so AVLA, as a tourism outlet, becomes more and more and more important. And so I would say, first of all, let's always remember what's number one. What is it that keeps us in food here? What is it that keeps us in jobs? And apart from the government agencies and the education agencies and the jails, but the government type agencies, it is ag and it is tourism. So we must put funds and energy behind those things that, that keep us going. I would also say, though, things like the Chevron development, we've got six developments that are in the pipeline, and not a one of them is there enough water for. There's not enough water for us right now today for the people who live here and for the people who visit. And so rather than wasting people's time and money on EIRs, I would say no more development until... if it's in the pipeline, then we've made a commitment. I would honor those commitments if we can. But until we can show a sustainable, long-term water supply that meets our needs and those of our visitors, we cannot be saying that that water can go to new development. And so I would suggest that we start telling the truth about that and quit making up funny numbers on that. So development and also parking. Circulation is an issue. The other issue is parking in Avila. So we have to have ingress and egress. We have to have parking, and we have to have water. And I think that the general plan is very good. Is really important, and we must work to that. And it has to be about scale. And then finally, I would say to Chevron, you don't clean it up as a condition of development. You clean it up first, and then we'll talk about development.
Thank you.
Good evening. I, unlike Avila, live in a tiny little area that has zero representation whatsoever. I have no services district. I have no advisory council. I live in the Bermuda Triangle between Oak Park, Noyce Canyon, and Ormondi Road off of Old Oak Park. So my question to you is, because I can't ask my current supervisor, because he's never to be found anywhere in my neighborhood, how will you represent my area, and how can I be involved in my community within that elusive little Bermuda Triangle of District 3 that is still Arroyo Grande?
Either way.
I'll go, I guess. Okay. Yeah. First of all, April, I have to commend you for bringing that to our attention, because as I walked precincts in your neighborhood, most of the folks had never seen their supervisor, had never met a supervisor, and didn't even know what district they were in, because they're the ones where the lines zigzag all over the place to kind of make the numbers work. And so I don't know the formula for how we get you representation there, but I do know the formula for how you get what you want done in government, and that is you come and you speak up. So if you need to create an informal group to represent your needs there, I think that's critical. But the other thing is, there are a lot of things that happen in your neighborhood that, as your supervisor, I would feel honor-bound to tell you, and I would not sleep at night if I didn't. For instance, if there was going to be a pipeline coming through your community from... and I was approving coming through your community from PXP all the way to Phillips 66, and it was going to be impacting your roads and your travel and your access, I would make sure, and I would do that as a right-of-way agent as well, because that's a right-of-way agency issue. I would make absolutely certain that everybody in that community knew that that was happening, number one. Number two, I would, and you know, I actually asked for the plan for that pipeline. It's never come my way yet. I'm going to have to ask again. So that's the critical thing. And there have been other things that have happened in the community that you haven't been advised about, and that just needs to happen. I know in speaking with Supervisor Compton, she was trying to figure out why she was always working so late at night, especially as compared to District 3 Supervisor Hill. And it's because Supervisor Hill, 3rd District Supervisor, is very fortunate in that lots of cities are governing people and looking after people. But down in Napomo, although they've got some advisory councils, really they depend on their supervisor to know what's going on, to be given the heads up. And we have a lot of areas like that, the Edna Valley, Avila, and that little conclave of six precincts out in eastern rural Arroyo Grande. So, I would be talking with you, and I would suggest that you get a group of sort of community organizers together and be active and proactive.
Great comment and question, April, and you and your neighbors suffered for a long time while that construction was going on in front of you. And I think that's a valid point, and you've raised it to me several times. And I think the supervisor, and this is the benefit Debbie and I bring that our supervisor doesn't have, is he has not served in a city. He does not understand that they are self-governing and that we're in a fortunate district where 90% of our population are in incorporated cities. So that leaves about 5,000 of you out there between Avila, Edna, rural San Luis, and rural Arroyo Grande that your supervisor can focus on and should have groups in each of those areas. We already have one in Avila, but why not have one in rural Arroyo Grande and one in Edna? That's one of the things I would encourage right off the bat. Every rural area, because that's where I see the action that is taken here in Avila with their advisory council. It's a wonderful, it's a small city council, and they do a great job. So I would suggest, and I, you know, briefly identified four areas, maybe rural San Luis, rural Arroyo Grande, Edna Valley, and then the Avila Valley area, and just set up four groups that I could attend once a month, and you have to afternoon or evening meeting. That's who really I would be representing. The cities do a pretty good job of representing themselves, and like I said, that's what Debbie and I bring, having been elected in cities. We know what happens in a city and how they are self-governing. Our current supervisor doesn't, and maybe that's why he spends his time in the city of San Luis getting in our business and in Pismo Beach and other places instead of being out in the areas that aren't represented. So I look forward to that sometime in the future, April.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hello, my name is Brett Strickland. I'm currently a candidate for San Luis Obispo City Council. As such, I'm a resident of San Luis. I know that the key to having good government is accessibility and transparency, so I'd like to know, as a supervisor, what both of you do to make yourself accessible to the public.
Well, I can tell you, I mean, the way to predict the future is what we've done in the past. My phone is with me all the time. If any, there are several of you in here that know how accessible I am. 7 days a week, probably 18 hours a day. If you call me, I will most likely pick up my phone. And that's the commitment I have as a public servant. It's a position that I took on willingly, and that's how I operate. Because I have been in San Luis strictly for the last 6 years, up until this last year of campaigning, people catch me on the street all the time. I walk through the districts, through the areas that I serve. That's the way to get in touch with the people you serve, is get out of your car and get into those areas. I would expect to do the same in all our areas in the district. I'm a hands-on person. You can reach me. If you happen to leave a message, you'll get a call back in a few hours. So I am very accessible, and I think that if you asked anybody who has been represented by me, they would concur with that.
I concur. You didn't represent me, but I know you.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for running. It's a big job, and if you need some advice or encouragement, feel free to pick up the phone. My cell phone number is the only phone I have. It's the only number I have. It's on everything I publish, and if you call it, you will reach me unless I'm talking to someone else, and then I will either turn it off or not take your call until I'm done. My email is the same. Every email address you've ever seen to me comes to exactly the same place. So if you contact me, you will reach me. And if you don't hear back from me within 24 hours, call again because it got dropped or something, because you will hear back from me. I have advocated tirelessly with several of our local agency attorneys to take actions that are more transparent. I recall being in a meeting where we were talking about the Brown Act, which protects, it's the Sunshine Law, it protects your right to speak, and it forces us to be more honest in most situations. And where I would be told before meetings, well, you know, you don't really have to open it up to public comment. And I would have three different people coming to me and saying, oh, don't open it up, they might say something awful. Mm-hmm. And I would smile and say, thank you, that's great advice, but I would like to know if they feel awful, because I can do something about it if they are really mad at me, but if they don't tell me, I can't do anything about it. And so, and I have, in some cases, as a protest, opened public comment twice when I was told I didn't have to open it at all. And so I think that it's taking a personal decision that you are going to make sure that you are transparent. That, and I would suggest also making sure that you read those laws yourself so that you really know what your agency attorney is telling you. And if you have any questions, raise it with the agency attorney or or an outside attorney.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Brett.
My name is Martin Suits, and I want to ask a question specifically about Avila. We have a number of projects that are in the works, problems or issues. You have the Chevron, you have Wild Cherry Canyon, you have Rossi on the golf course, as well as the events that are unpermitted at this time. What would you do different than Adam Hill?
You want me to start?
Sure.
Okay. First thing I would do is not take money from the developers. And I say that because money is influence. And I'm going to start there because they all have expectations. They've all spent money with their supervisor, and they have expectations. So what would I do differently is what I continue to do now. I meet with all those developers anyway because most all of them, and I could go through the names, have developments in the city of San Luis too. Not once have they ever offered me a check because they don't need that kind of influence with me. First thing you do is sit down and be honest with them and don't say, write me a check and I'll make sure this gets through. Honest with them, look, we don't have the water, sewer, the circulation issues need to be dealt with first. If I were you, I would hold off. I would hold off until we get the Bay Area plan done, and then let's see where it's identified for development. Absolutely be honest with them, and I think that's what our representation is not. As I meet with these people, it's my sense that their representation is not being honest with them about what really can happen, what really is out there. Realistically, instead of giving them that false sense of hope that, well, we'll start the process and just keep it rolling and I'll advocate for it, that's not the way I do my business. So I hope that answers your question.
Events ordinance. Instead of kicking the can down the road, we need to get all of us together. We need to put it on the agenda. We need to meet and meet and meet until we come to a solution. And I know that that's something of concern to a number of you, and also as the canary in the mine to a number of other other local agencies. So we need to look at all of the facts. We need to look at how it impacts communities. We need to look how it impacts ag. We need to look at how important events are to our local economy, and then we need to find a way to make it work for all of us. And it may not be the same game plan for every community. Avila is a really different community than Edna, and so we may have different rules for different communities, but we need to I don't like political expediency unless it really does serve a purpose. So I would really like to see us let's take the elephant in the room and let's invite it to sit down and let's talk.
Good evening, Ms. Peterson and Mr. Carpenter. My name is Steve Reebok. I live in San Luis Obispo. The National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration was in Morro Bay on January 6th to promote a new National Marine Sanctuary for our coast. What they're telling us is the primary need is to stop offshore oil development. In 1986, voters of the county passed Measure A. Been in effect now for 30 years. It would prohibit offshore oil development onshore, the staging areas, without another vote of the citizens. So my question to both of you is, would you favor that type of approach, a local approach, or would you favor going to the federal government for management?
I'm forgetting the order, but
Go ahead if you're ready.
I will almost always favor a local approach, and it makes me think of the, and I'm really glad you brought that to our attention because it was many years ago and we tend to forget, especially our developers and our politicians tend to forget, especially when they get really nice donations from special interest groups. And we get tunnel vision. So like the DREAM initiative not that long ago in 2000, where the whole county, but especially Avila Beach, said, we want you to keep the PG&E lands when PG&E goes away. We want you to keep those lands in perpetuity for ag and for recreation. We want them kept open. We want them conserved, preserved. And somehow everybody forgot about that when it looks like they might be able to develop Wild Cherry Canyon. But we made a commitment to the voters. The voters voted. They told us what they wanted. You cannot override a vote of the people unless the people vote again to override it. And so I think this is a very similar thing. If we took a vote, we honor the vote. We always honor the vote. That's what our country is about.
Very good.
Let me be a little more specific on that, Steve. I was at that meeting in Morro Bay, as you may remember, and I think it was a propaganda for NOAA and their presentation of the sanctuary. I do not agree with the sanctuary. We do not need it. I think with Measure A, we have protected our coastline from offshore oil coming to shore. And my biggest concern, and I've had it for the communities of, all the coastal communities, but especially Avila and Morro Bay, where there's a large fishing community, that type of impact will be negative on those coastal economies. I'm afraid the fishermen will be, they'll be limited in the areas. We've seen that happen in Monterey Bay. I talked to the Monterey Bay harbor manager, and he said, first thing to do, federal government comes in with the sanctuary, and it's all great, and we're not going to prohibit anything. And then they start taking away fishery areas one by one, and now you've diminished those coastal economies. And so the propaganda they're using is that it brings more tourism dollars. I don't see how that happens. When I stand at the end of the pier when it's fixed, I don't see anything out there that says sanctuary. We're still going to have this beautiful coastline. The waters are protected. I think it's a layer of federal government we don't need. We need to keep the local control. We passed the measure, and so I do not agree with the sanctuary.
Well, you do have in the county, we do have a 30-year good track record, and I would like to add to that. You mentioned fishing, but it's also inland. It has to do with the watershed, because inland waters run into the ocean. Landowners and farmers, ranchers could also be affected. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Yes, sir.
Good evening, candidates. Tom Guernsey, Avila Beach. Thank you for being here. Debbie spoke a little bit about one thing that I wanted to address. And for almost 20 years now, Avila Beach has been caught in the grips of promoters and developers on issues of events and the impacts to the community. And this has been addressed to the current Board of Supervisors and past Boards of Supervisors for, like I'm saying, it's almost going on 20 years now. It got to a point where the grand jury stepped in and did a study and issued a report back to the Board of Supervisors, asking them to please have an events ordinance in place in a certain amount of time. That was over 2 years ago. So I was wondering if you both could elaborate a little bit more on that issue and what you could do to help the community and the concerns of the citizens.
Okay, I'll go ahead, Tom. Thank you. See, I try to go back, and I follow the money. Why is the county continue to ignore and allow these events? Because there's a revenue stream coming into the county. The county, like many agencies, are addicted to revenue. And any idea of cutting back revenue or restricting revenue, the red flags go up. Well, we don't want to do that because they have these long-term commitments, and some of them are pensions, retirements. They have to meet those commitments. And so it's always a struggle to get an agency to reduce their revenue stream. And so I think the reluctance is that, and that goes right along with the development, the events ordinance as well, is, well, we don't want to be too restrictive because look at the money it brings. And look at all the tourist dollars and the tax dollars and the stuff that comes into the county. We don't want to lose any of that. And so I believe that's where the hesitation is. And at some point, you have to bite the bullet and say, enough. I follow the money. Why would you want to allow all of those large events out there when we know it's not possible or it's
impacting the quality of life that the residents here have when you're bringing in those thousands of vehicles. And so I think it needs to be looked at there again as part of this San Luis Bay Area plan, and what type of events as well as what type of development we're going to have here. It's unlikely that the ingress and egress out of Avila is going to change anytime soon. So what is a comfortable number in that ordinance? And I think it's really pulling together people who have a vested interest in this area and having them tell us, what do you feel comfortable with, and going from there.
I agree with Dan on what he's saying on all of that. I would want to push that it be agendized, that we stop running away from it, and that if possible that we incorporate it as part of our general plan. And I'm not in favor of overregulation. I'm really much more interested in people having property rights and personal liberties. And when it really impacts the quality of life, then we have to start looking at those things. And this is one of those that we have to look at. So I would push to get it on the agenda. I would push to make it part of the general plan. And I would address scale. In San Luis Obispo, you're talking about the scale of building heights right now, but we're really talking about the scale of development. What's the scale that's the right size and comfortable for our little community here?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I noticed the line is getting short, so I thought I'd better get in line. My name is Dave Kirk. I'm an organic farmer, commercial fisherman. I also process and retail our local caught fish out of my store, Windmill Farms. And I was a resident of Avila for more than a decade, and I currently live in Arroyo Grande. And I'm love this community. I currently serve in Avila in a couple of areas. I'm a member of CMANC, and that's the Conference of Harbors up and down the state of California, who has came out in opposition to the Marine Sanctuary, and our harbor district has also come out with a resolution in opposition, and I've labored to try to encourage our supervisors to follow suit. And of course our representative here is not willing to do that, which is very unfortunate, and which I can't understand why he would be so willing to hand over our power to the federal government. And I don't really have a question, but I think your assessment, Dan, of the whole situation with NOAA is very accurate. And what I've seen in the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, which is dominated by an environmental community, and which I consider myself an environmentalist, you know, I want to be a good steward of the land and a good steward of the sea. But I don't see any good coming from the federal government. It seems to me they want to dominate special interests, and it's all about who owns these fish out here. Right now, we're unable to harvest these fish. And I would like to see our harbor go back to what it was at one time and have fresh fish available to the local people that would like to buy a piece of fish. And it's really not a question. It's just a statement to follow up on what Steve Rebuck said. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. And I think just as a quick comment, you make a very valid point. The federal government does not, their local control is always better than any other control. And I think that's why when we get down at this level, you get to talk to us. As you start to go up the food chain in elected officials, it's tough to get in touch with them. So I'm glad you're here. Once again, you get to have local control. And that's what we should always be advocating for.
Yeah, you know, Dan Lundgren addressed the growers in the state of California about a decade ago and said this was coming, and he was certainly right. It was a prophecy fulfilled. My opinion is the federal government, the EPA, NOAA, these agencies together would, I'm a stakeholder, and I realize a lot of you people in this room, you're not, and what you're concerned about your own personal interests, but I would probably, if this goes through, disappear like swatting a fly.
Well, thank you for your service, and please don't disappear.
My name is Miss Welsh, and I reside in Arroyo Grande. I am also the widow to a veteran who died of cancer because of what our government sprayed on him during the Vietnam War. So my question to you is, he might have survived had I been able to give him an appetite during his chemotherapy, which means if I could have given him medical marijuana in an edible form, I might have saved his life. What is your feeling about the medical marijuana issues going on today?
Well, I'll tackle that one. Especially when I hear cases that you're describing, marijuana is in many ways like any other medication. It should be controlled. It should be carefully used. It can have very negative effects, especially, I think, amongst young boys. And if it's the only relief, or if it's a good relief, and it's less, and the side effects are less, then I fully support medical marijuana being easily and affordably available to those who need it.
As you know, a lot of the problems we have is because we have inconsistency with the federal laws, the state laws, and our local governing laws. And I dealt with this several times in the last 6 years, is that we have a federal government who continues to keep marijuana illegal to possess or use. And then you have them saying, well, we're not going to prosecute if the states want to go ahead and do it. And we're fortunate we have a Compassionate Care Act in our state. And it has allowed us to get that product to the people who need it. And we have lots of mobile dispensaries in our area. I think in our city we have over 30 of them that deliver that responsibly to people. I think what happens is the pushback and the confusion comes is that we're not all given the same information. When you have the federal government who's not partnering with the states and the states aren't partnering with your local jurisdiction, you've got, and you've probably seen lately, every local agency passed some kind of emergency ordinance regarding the law that's going into effect in California. And they're all over the board. Some are banning all the production of marijuana. Some, like our city, we did not ban medical marijuana growth in your own property. We recognize that was inconsistent with what the state law is, it was consistent with the state law, but inconsistent with the federal law. But we went ahead and did it anyway. But you've seen other jurisdictions do it differently. So, first of all, I am sorry for the loss of your husband. I think that's very sad. And if that could have relieved some of the pain he went through, I'm sorry you didn't have that available or as accessible as you wanted it. I think, once again, we need to get our agencies together where we convey to our state legislators, look, if this is what works in our community, we need your support. And hopefully they will take that. And our congressional representative in Washington, D.C., will take that back and say, you know what, let's all get on the same page so we're not outlawing, turning people into outlaws.
Thank you.
Hi, I live in SLO, and I want to say Dan's right. I run into him all the time. I'm always surprised. So. It's great. My question is, if you were elected to the Board of Supervisors, what would your, like, one or two key issues, priorities be? Anything you're interested in that you'd like to see move forward?
I think it's actually your turn.
Oh,
I'm happy. If you want me to.
No, it's up to you. I've been going first a lot, but you're
okay.
Welcome
all
to.
Right. Well,
I have a bunch, but you go ahead.
All right. Yeah, that I was trying to think through what my top three were, and I realized I have more than three. Number one, we cannot make it without water. So number one is to push very, very hard for a holistic plan that covers all the options for the whole county and does the cost-benefit analysis and looks at short, immediate emergency, short-term and long-term planning, and looks at how we fund all of that. Number one, water. Number two, integrity in government makes a whole lot of difference. Because if we do not have fiscal integrity, if we do not have fiscal accountability, then you suffer, all of you suffer, because the money that's being wasted is money that could be put to use serving you better. And that takes us to infrastructure.
most of our infrastructure throughout the United States has not been upgraded since the 1960s, and that's why our pipelines are leaking, and that's why our bridges are failing, and our roads are failing. And I think it's only a very, very small amount of our budget, just a few million dollars out of a almost $600 million budget goes towards infrastructure, and that must change. We need to keep driving on the roads, and the dirt roads, especially when the dirt roads down in the Pomo area are contributing to bad air quality and are recognized as the number one contributor. So infrastructure is very important. It's not sexy, but it matters. And I was the one who got the roads ordinance, the bond through in Grover Beach to fix those roads. And we need to, those elephants in the room need to be addressed. So I'll stop there. There are more, but I'll stop at those three for now.
I will try to go through them quickly. Water, obviously, it's an issue. And for me, and it's county policy, is we should be maximizing the efficiency of every source we have for water. And I know we're moving forward with desal in a way that, in a feasibility study. But at the same time, we've got to be looking at all our other sources. I think we've been negligent in providing surface storage. In fact, my uncle, who was a 4th District Supervisor back in the late 60s and early 70s, he was the one that pushed Lopez Dam. So for 46, 47 years, we have not built any water storage. And I think that's the big problem. We're not getting the water, we're not stopping the water before it goes to the ocean, and so then it's getting out there, and then we have all these environmental issues of bringing it back in. If we stopped it and we delivered it to the people locally, I think we could do a better job. And we live in a state with a lot of environmental regulations, and so there's reasons we don't build dams. But I think if water is our top priority, and I believe it is, then we need to set that aside because it is the essence of our life. Second, I would say, is housing. I addressed that earlier, so I'm not going to go into it again. I think all over the county we do need to find a new way of establishing affordable housing by design, smaller lot sizes, smaller homes for people. That's the way people want to live these days. The third is the transportation infrastructure, and I agree with Debbie. Our state has been negligent in this, passing the budget last year, and they left that out of the budget because they wanted to spend that money on other frilly things. And so now they have pushed it back to the local communities, and they have the self-help program where if you'll pass a local tax, then we'll help you. But if you're not going to do it, we're not going to help you. So I think 19 out of the 58 counties have already signed in to the self-help program. But it's unfair to those that couldn't pass a tax or choose not to pass a tax that our legislators in Sacramento have neglected something so important. And we see it here locally. If you're driving out of San Luis to the South County or in the morning and it's backed up traffic, we don't have the money to do it. And so there again, the state continues to push things onto us locally, and that's an unfunded mandate in essence. They're saying, you take care of it. We'll help you if you want to do it. But it's not that they didn't have the money. It's they chose it to spend. They chose to spend it somewhere else. That would be the third. So transportation, housing, and water, I think, are what would be my top three. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin, for having this debate tonight. Thank you both for being here. Civility has been a big problem at the Board of Supervisors the last few years. Supervisor Hill and Gibson have bullied people who come up in front of the microphone. They have they spent an hour chastising our district attorney over $2,800 at a recent board meeting. They ridiculed and made fun of a state geologist when he was speaking in front of the board. Even threatened to have him removed from his job. I want to know how you are going to stop that kind of misbehavior by fellow board members, because people on both sides of the aisle are tired of it, and it needs to stop. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Absolutely, it's unacceptable. I mean, it's just, I don't know what other word to attach here. It's just not how we act as adults.
and how we act as your representative. There again, I think in the two supervisors you mentioned have been there a long time. They start to take ownership of that position, and the next thing that you know, that they have full control of the meeting. I think, and I give Supervisor Arnold a lot of credit last year as the chair. She was very welcoming to speakers at the podium, and I think that's the approach I would take. If we have to be there till 8 o'clock at night taking public comment, that's what I want to do. I want to hear from my constituents. I want to hear respectfully from them, and I think we get what we give. And if we're respectful to them, they're going to be very respectful to us. I see the discourse right now. I think we all do if you go to the board meeting. And I think we breed that. The board breeds it, and so people come there anxious, ready to jump on each other because that's the culture that's been created there. So how do you fix it? Get rid of the two people that are causing the problem.
The first two meetings I went to when I was first elected, I alienated our current supervisor by stopping to think about what I wanted to teach my 17-year-old son and his friends about how we act as role models and servants of the community. And I could not find it in my heart to say to them that it was okay to govern the way that two of our current supervisors are governing, even though we're in the same political party. It makes no difference. You cannot operate that way. And so I think there are things you can do in meetings when you're the chair of the meeting or when you're a member of the meeting, harder to do when you're out in watching. But you can shout order, and you can suggest that you can say you're out of order. You can't talk like that. That's not acceptable. Because if you've elected us, we should be held to a higher standard. If you're out there, you've got 3 minutes, and things have been brewing with you for a long time, and you're mad, good. Come tell us about it. And you have the right to be mad. But we need to be listening to you, and we need to be held to a higher standard. And I think we need to call it out. I have sometimes been kind of frustrated because it has not been called out as much as I would like to see it called out. But again, your vote is what makes the difference there. Thank you.
My name is Greg Cordova, and since I've retired for the last 10 years, I've been volunteering for the homeless shelters, Sunny Acres, Maxine Lewis, Prado. I'm currently on do the San Luis Obispo Suicide Prevention Mental Health Resource Hotline, and we constantly get calls with people desperate for mental health resources for their loved ones and for themselves. And my question to you is, here there's millions of dollars being spent on these new additions for the county jail over there over the last few years, and yet there's been cuts for county mental health and cuts for drug and alcohol. So what could you do to see that, you know, more resources are available for people who need it?
I'll go. You know, I think that really does boil down to fiscal accountability. I am certain that there are ways that we can be more accountable, and one of the first ways to do it is to ask the people who are in the departments who are doing things, how can we do this more effectively so that we have the funds available? Now, there's, in a government agency, there's going to be some resistance, but the reality is it's the people down on the floor who are doing the job that know how it can be done best. And so I think that if we are fiscally accountable, if you have people who are running businesses, running your board and running your county, they are going to be much more effective at doing that, and that makes funds available for the other things also. So it is a priority. If we want to help with the homeless situation, we must deal with addiction. We must deal with mental health issues, and we must put money towards it. And that's one of the biggest problems we're having right now in the homeless situation, is that there's so little funding that the few homeless agencies are all chasing the same dollars, and they're not operating efficiently and effectively. And we must address that. We have to find a way to get us all to sit down together and remember who it is we're working for and what it is we need to do, and not step in one another's way. And part of that will be finding the funding. So some of it's going to be mindset. Some of it's going to be working with the folks who are there already. I did come to the meeting and I've strongly advocated for that mental health hospital, and I'm so happy that we're going to have help for people who need it.
I think
First of all, thank you for volunteering. That's really important. We have so many volunteers in our community, and we're very fortunate. Over half the people that our law enforcement comes in contact with have mental challenges that are not being addressed, and we turn them into criminals without giving them the proper opportunity for medication and treatment. One place I continue to advocate for, and I will continue to do it, is I have in the past and will continue, is the old San Luis General Hospital. You remember it was taken out of commission 25 years ago, and it's important to me. It actually is 500 feet from my house, and I've watched this for years since they closed it. It's a perfect opportunity for the county to take responsibility, a piece of property down. The building is already set up with small rooms to treat inpatient treatment, and the county, I've offered it, I've suggested it, I've tried to ask them to act on it. They continue to neglect it and push it off to the private sector. I think that's a responsibility of the county to provide that, and as long as we allow them to do that, they lease out the building basically to lots of different agencies, and they're healthcare agencies. But what a perfect building that has already been set up for that type of housing to house inpatient. We're terribly negligent in dealing with that segment of the population, and that would be one of the first suggestions. We already have it sitting there. Yes, go ahead.
This is an amazing evening. Thank you both for being here. And our host to do this, how blessed. I'm about ready to go home. I have a gentleman who's 90 years old who can't stay up this late. But what I want to say, because I want to put the elephant back on the table. Dan, you're sitting there. Debbie, you're sitting there. Adam Hill is a friend of mine. Sad. I'm sad he doesn't care enough about Avila to be here tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Hi, I'm Nancy Skidmore. I live in AG. I am not in your district. But the question I do have for both of you is, with all the shenanigans, as we call them, going on in the supervisors' meeting and the bullying happening, how come the other supervisors don't try to put a stop to it while it's going on? And will you?
I think that's a question for them, and I will.
Well, I will stop it, definitely. I think it's being allowed. There's so much, they want to go along to get along. And I don't think that's how we represent you. I think each of us have to represent our constituency and the county as a whole. And if this is not good for good governance to see that kind of activity going on up there, then we need to call them out on it. Not be afraid to step on people's toes by saying, this is enough. We need to stop. Not worry about where we're getting our next votes the next time we're up for election. And just do the right thing and stop it. Go ahead, Betty.
Thank you for coming. My name is Betty Woody, and I'm going to ask you one question. But first, I want you to know I've sat through these meetings for 17 years. Peg Pinard, Jerry Lenthal, Adam Hill, and now you. And I hear the same questions being asked over and over and over again. My one question to you is, when is the talking going to stop and I can see some action?
Thank you, Betty, and happy birthday.
It'll stop, Betty, when you get rid of the current supervisor.
Hi, my name is Ron Mollick from SLO. And you've talked about tourism being a driver for the economy in this area, and that's great, but new restaurants and new hotels do not create jobs that allow families to live here. What we need, I think, is technology companies, clean manufacturing companies. What obstacles do you see to bringing them in this area, and how would you resolve those obstacles so that we can have more family income jobs out here? Thank you.
The biggest obstacle is planning. It's a government that's all caught up and doesn't recognize that we need to enable that kind of a thing. And so I think one of the biggest things we can do is to continue to streamline our planning processes and to fast track and to be supportive of new businesses. We also have a number of areas. Grover Beach has 100 acres, inexpensive ocean view manufacturing, clean manufacturing area. And I can tell you for years I've looked at that and I've been sad that we aren't doing more at a county level to help support that, to help support our community. And so I know that there are other areas where we have done it. We've done it in Paso Robles, and we're doing it in San Luis Obispo. The other secret is fiber optic. If you look at San Luis Obispo and you look at why we're thriving, the way we're thriving in San Luis Obispo, it's because in that county area, we've laid down some of the fastest and widest fiber optic lines that you'll find anywhere in the world. And in Grover Beach, we have a connection that will take you anywhere in the world as fast, faster than LA or San Francisco. So we have the opportunity to tap into some of those resources. And if we can do that, they will come.
I think for me, it goes back to housing again. We see businesses leaving because their employees can't find housing. We have businesses who contact us constantly, wanting light manufacturing, wanting to come to our area. First impediment is, where are my employees going to live? Well, you don't have affordable housing. I can't afford to pay them, start them off at $50 an hour to afford the housing you have. So I think they're going to have to go back to where are we deficient, and we're deficient in housing. Once we provide the housing, the infrastructure is there to bring in those type of jobs. And we need to incentivize them too, incentivize those type of businesses. And there again, that's sacrificing some of the fees and impact fees and permitting fees up front so that they will invest in our community. But we have to do it in housing as well as in a commercial and industrial. Go ahead.
It seems that most everything boils down to money in the long run, and we've been spending a lot of time talking about how to shift it from here to there to get it where we need it. Maybe we don't need the train to nowhere, things like that. Dan, I really appreciated you shedding a lot of light on the salary issues. I mean, I knew that was a problem, but you really broke it down and took it to a whole new level of understanding for me. It's shocking to me that we have a major university here that is known for the entrepreneurship, the brilliant students, the scholastic achievement, and we're obsessed with hiring people from outside. I find that absolutely insane. And while we're on the subject of salaries, somebody please tell me what Adam Hill's salary is.
Well, he's the best paid of all the supervisors, and I'd like to figure out how he does that. But it's I think with all the benefits, it's in the 90,000. Is that right? There was something in the paper recently about
base salary is 84,000 something, I believe, and then the benefits actually probably put him over 100,000
or more with health care and everything else.
Right, and then also there is pay benefits for some of the commissions you serve on, and so those add up pretty quickly.
Well, I think we paid him enough to where he could stay after school and meet with the kids.
Oh, thank you.
Anybody else?
You done asking questions?
Shall we wind up? Mm-hmm. How soon are we going to have action? Well, how about we do our wind up now? Each of us do our wind up, and then maybe we can answer that question when we do that. Are you ready to?
I can't if you'd like me.
I can't remember who was going to go first.
It doesn't matter. I'm good either
way. If you're ready, fine, and I'll
sure
pull my notes together.
First of all, thank you everyone for coming tonight. Obviously, this is wonderful turnout, and I think our supervisors not here missed out on an opportunity to face you face to face like I and Debbie have chosen to do. It's an opportunity. Any time we have that, we serve you, and I think about that. I don't really have any power. The power I use, you guys give to me, and I take that responsibility. I don't take it lightly. It's a huge responsibility. You give me power, you give me your money, and it's a heavy burden. And I think when we start to look at it as self-serving, we start to do things that benefit us personally, I think it's time to go. And that's why I think it's time for the supervisor to move on to whatever he wants to do next. I think it's time for a change in this district. I think I am that person. And let me tell you why I think I am, notwithstanding my experience and my background and having spent many years in the community, I won my last election with more votes. My votes in the city of San Luis were more than the Supervisor Hill received in the entire district. Our county, our district, more than half of San Luis, about 61%, is in this district. That's about 27,000-28,000 people of the 58 that are in the district, more or less. I'm already representing those people. I look forward to serving the rest of the district. I think when I change positions and move from the city to the county, I recognize my responsibility is to those rural areas that I mentioned when April was up here. That shifts away. I understand what it is to be a city council person, as does Debbie. Your responsibility there is different than as a supervisor, and so I will be focusing on those areas. And I think we've talked a lot tonight. I think you've got a feel for each of us, and I'm open to more questions later if you want to stick around. I don't want to make this a long ending speech, but you can always go to my website, dancarpentersupervisor.com. It's very interactive. We answer questions. You can order a yard sign. You can donate. You can do lots of fun things. I am so proud of the volunteers that have given their time and energy to get me elected. These are people that believe in me. They don't expect anything in return. They just believe in me. And I think in a community, when you start to look at what a community's value is and its quality, it depends on the integrity of the leaders. And I think that's what we're lacking in this district. And that integrity comes from not how you vote, but how you behave yourself, how you act. And so I think when you have a supervisor that is not behaving appropriately, maybe they're voting the right way, but when they're not behaving appropriately, it's a reflection on the entire community, and it does not serve us well. And so what I hope to do as your supervisor is bring my years of experience, my proven ability to win elections, which means that somebody out there likes me, a few people do, and think I serve well. I think coming from a larger community, even though I'm not, would be representing the entire district, and in all, with all due respect to Ms. Peterson, she comes from Grover Beach, a smaller community, and I'm not discounting that, but I come from a community with a lot of people, and I have that experience of serving that type of community. I've been elected as an incumbent. I'm happy to keep moving forward with you guys, and I hope you give me that opportunity on June 7th, and we wrap it up then. The term would start January 1st. It would give whoever of us win, hopefully Debbie or I, the opportunity to really engage in what's happening in the transition from Supervisor Hill to one of us. So I look forward to your support. Thank you tonight.
I'd like to address Betty's question. First of all, I met Betty when I was walking precincts, and she was just coming back from doing some gardening because she's doing all the gardening around the sidewalks here. I can't remember the reason why, but thank you, Betty, for all your years of service. I know the supervisors thanked you a few weeks back, and happy birthday on your 90th, which wasn't too long ago. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about action. I want to talk a little bit about some of the things, other points that I missed as we were going along. Having worked abroad and having not grown up here, although I'm thrilled that my son did, and that's why I moved here to this community for quality of life, I have the benefit of a wider perspective. Having been mayor, I have a benefit of a wider perspective. And that wider perspective has been something that has helped me a great deal in doing some of the more action-oriented, maybe some of the first things that have happened. And so I was the first person in the South County to, and as far as I'm aware, in the whole county, to hold a water seminar. And that was on October 27th, 2013. No one else had even thought of it at that point, but I could see it coming down the road. So I was the first to do that. I got that ball rolling. On the sanitation district, which you've read a lot about recently, we were losing
about $1 million a year, and I was able to go in and see that there was a problem. I was able to talk with the board and headhunt someone who didn't have a conflict of interest to go in and do the restructuring that needed to be done. I also headhunted someone. Thank you. I also was able to headhunt someone from outside our county who didn't have a conflict of interest and worked with a number of volunteers who have been working on this for 14 years now. It took us 3 years, but we finally convinced through public outreach and public effort to the board, we finally convinced them that we needed to figure out how never to do that again and how to make sure that our special districts are truly representing people. And so we finally completed our Knutson report. I recruited the man who was working with Price Waterhouse on the Enron deal. He also was the IRS agent when Oliver North was called out, and he worked also on the largest money laundering case in the United States with the Colombian drug dealers in the 80s as an IRS agent who found that out. I was able to, because of my background and experience, I was able to go out and find that guy, and the board agreed, and they eventually put him in, and he's come back with some very important information that needs to be applied countywide. And that comes from background experience. I also wanted to give you a couple of more bits on the mental health, the homeless. The homeless situation will always be with us, and we will only fix it by chipping away. It's like a lot of things. When you don't have enough money, it doesn't help just to bring in more money. You also have to cut your expenditure, and then you really get that more money. And well, the homeless thing is the same. We're going to need to chip away at it in a whole lot of different ways and understand, and that the agencies have really helped us with this, but understand that there are different segments of that community that are going to respond to different kinds of treatment, and we need to address those individually. And one of the things that we mentioned was the Transitions Mental Health Housing First model, and the county has been working on that for 9 months, and they have exceeded all of their goals. So I would love to see our county our board really continue to support that effort because it's working. And finally, I wanted to let you know that I am known for doing my homework. I'm known for paying attention, for reading. And I'm also known for speaking out whether or not it's in my best interest. There will be cases where I think it's in your best interest, and I will pay a price, and I have, and I will continue to do that, because that, as Dan has mentioned, integrity is number one, and I'm going to go for that first. And I am not reaching out to the developers who are funding Adam Hill. And so just so all of you know, if you are not funding Adam Hill, it would be useful to fund one of the candidates who you believe in. It will help us to get the message out. So I'm hoping that you will do that, and I'm hoping that you will also, when you get to the ballot box, when you see that little mark that says you have to put a dot in the bubble or send something off, I'm hoping that you'll choose Debbie Peterson. Thank you for your time tonight.
That's it.
We're done.
Thank you, everyone.